From the studios of KUSP FM in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Kathleen Miller returns to the show this week. She's the author of the bestseller Desert Flower, and her new book is called Champion of Choice, The Life and Legacy of Women's Advocate Nafis Sadiq. Kathleen Miller, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
It's great to be here. I love this jazzy music. I already feel like a celebrity.
I'm glad to hear it. Did I say it right? Nafis Sadiq?
Nafis Sadiq.
Nafis Sadiq. Well, I didn't have to know how to pronounce it while I was reading this book. You've been working on this book since I met you, which I think was like 7 or 8 years ago. Well, so congratulations, because here it is.
Thank you.
Did you know when you started that you would be spending such a long time working on it?
Let's be clear. It's actually been since 2001. No, I never dreamed that I would be involved with this book. 10 years writing it, and then another year with all of the production, and now another year for the promotion. So the word to the wise here is be careful what you get into, because you'll be living with it for a long time.
Well, are you tired of Nafis Sadiq, or was she really that engaging that it was worth 14 years of your life?
She is an incredible person, and even though I didn't really plan on spending 12 years of my life with the book, the longer I was involved with her, the more I realized how important the work is that she has done, and so I did feel good about spending so much time on this endeavor.
I want to know all about those years that you spent, but I want to know, let's go back to like the beginning. Mm-hmm. Desert Flower was a hugely successful book. They made a movie out of it.
Yeah.
And how did that open the door for this book? Is there a connection?
Yes, absolutely. The day that Waris Dirie was made a special ambassador to the UN, she was an advocate to stop female genital mutilation, and I just happened to be in New York City to interview Waris for Desert Flower. And in that strange way of life where kind of different events converge, I just happened to be there to interview her for the book. She announces, oh, by the way, tomorrow I'm going into a swearing-in ceremony at the UN and a reception to become a special ambassador. Would you like to come? And I said, duh, I'm writing your life story. Yeah, I think that's a good idea. So I went, and at the reception, I met Nafis Sadiq. I met who was at that time the executive director of the UN Population Fund. And I also met a man who would become a really pivotal person in my life. His name is Sterling Scruggs. And Sterling is a good old boy from Tennessee, so as a couple of Southerners, we hit it off. And he was also the director of communications for UN Population Fund. And so fast forward several years, and one day Sterling calls me in Napa and says, would you be interested in writing the life story of Nafis? And I'm astonished. And he said, you know, we have seen the power of what Desert Flower has done as a tool of advocacy, and nobody has ever written Nafis's biography, although she's had this extraordinary career. And so I was astonished and very flattered, and so naturally let my ego get the better of me and said yes.
And so then what happened? I mean, how did you proceed? I mean, what, you have this gigantic, I mean, it's a, when I was reading this book, and it's a major book. It's, I don't know how many pages, but it's, you know, it's
500
pages. And it's not only that, but it's not just a linear story of one person's life, because you talk about all the issues and other cases and all the way through. So how did you go about organizing it and figuring out how you would approach it?
Well, that's a really good question. I've started interviewing Nafis after Sterling called me. I tried to make an appointment to go to New York City and interview her, and immediately realized what I had gotten myself into, as I say in the introduction, that I discovered it was like handcuffing myself to the bumper of a racing fire engine, because I was trying to schedule an appointment for our first meeting, and I'm living in Napa, California at the time, so it's not exactly like I just hop in a taxi. And so in 1 month, I think at the time she was 72 years old, she had meetings in Rio de Janeiro, Durban, South Africa, and Geneva, Switzerland. And so, anyway, I went to Manhattan. I rented an apartment there. I began to interview her, and I interviewed a lot of her colleagues at the UN, and I began to realize that one of the problems they were having was that the work they do is very abstract to most Americans. We don't live in a developing country. We don't have many of the issues that they're fighting for, like, thank God, female genital mutilation, like obstetric fistula. Although trafficking exists here, it's invisible to Americans. And so I thought, I need to find a way to make people realize what's at stake. And I had a real political agenda, because the United States Congress had canceled all the funding to UNFPA, which is happening again. And I wanted readers to understand what is really involved with this funding issue. And so I questioned for a long time as I was writing, how am I going to handle this in the book? And so I decided to do what I always do as a rhetorical tool, and that is to use stories to let people understand. So I approached the UN and I said, I think that it's important for me to tell the stories of your constituents, the people that you are trying to help. And so I embarked on this trip around the world, and I found these women and girls in all of these different countries and interviewed them and told their stories, and found stories that really personify these various issues, like FGM, like fistula, like trafficking, like a woman who had 9 children because she was trying to have a boy. So I think these are more powerful tools than statistics or, you know, policy mantras. People understand these on human terms.
Where did you go when you say you traveled the world? Specifically, where did you visit?
Well, the stories I found in Kosovo, I interviewed survivors of the rape camps there. I went to Kenya, I went to Ghana, I went to Pakistan, I went to India, Egypt, East Timor, Argentina, Bolivia. I'm missing a few places, I'm sure.
Well, but now, how did you manage there? I mean, do you speak all those languages? I don't think so.
I'm still working on English.
So did you have a guide in each place, or, and how could you rely on what the information you were getting and so forth?
Well, those are also very good questions. I would get into the country. Not only did I not speak the language, sometimes, like in Ethiopia, I didn't even know what the language was. I didn't know what the currency was. I would just go to the ATM machine and see what came out. But I would be corresponding with people at the UN offices, and many times they would connect me to the various NGOs and non-governmental organizations they work with. And so through this web of various advocates, I would go out into the community and find people to interview. And I did a lot of interviews, and whichever one is in the book, I decided was the one that worked the best for the book. And so I would have people to translate, like I was in the fistula hospital in Addis Ababa, and the nurses were translating for me. And it was quite complicated, but the stories were intense.
Give us an example.
Like, for instance, a young woman who she had a club foot, and so she couldn't walk to church with her family. And she stayed at home one day while they all went to church, and the neighbor came over and raped her. And so then she had the baby. She got pregnant and she had a baby, and it just destroyed her body. And so she had a fistula and worked for 2 years to just get the money to for transport, for bus fare, to get to Addis Ababa to the hospital where she could get the free surgery. So, I mean, some of these are incredibly tragic stories, but also I really tried to connect these stories of victimization to what became, in all except one case, a story of advocacy, where these people started off in a situation of trauma, and then these issues began to work towards helping other women.
We're talking to Kathleen Miller, and Dr. Miller is the author of Birdhouse Chronicles and Desert Flower, and now this wonderful new book, which is called Champion of Choice. And she's going to be appearing at the Capitola Book Cafe August 12th?
August 12th at 7:30.
So you should go over and meet Kathy. So did you find then, you know, how did this affect you personally, emotionally, you know, dealing with all this stuff?
You must be a professional interviewer. These are really good questions. I did not fare that well while I was on this tour. I was meeting so many people and so engaged in all the work that it was fascinating. But then when I got back home, and started to try to write about it. You're a nonfiction writer, so you understand that when you're writing these stories of other people, to do it right, you have to relive that experience. So it was quite depressing, and it was something that I had to work very hard to overcome. In fact, I wound up having to see a hypnotherapist who helped me get through this. So it was really kind of a fascinating experience.
What did the hypnotherapist do for you?
She kind of, you know, talked me through this whole thing about the fact that I had this block about writing about all this. And, you know, as you do in some kind of therapy, you know, it's all kind of magic. It's kind of voodoo. I don't really understand what she did. And the whole time, I mean, I'm from Missouri, so I'm thinking, oh, my God, I can't believe I'm spending money for this stuff. And then it worked, so what could I say?
Yeah, well, but you wanted it to work, too, right?
Of course.
So you really, after you accumulated all of the information that you were going to use for Champion of Choice, you had trouble writing it.
I had trouble writing it for several reasons. One was the emotional impact. The second one was I was teaching four courses a semester at San Jose State, and the third one was I just had a massive amount of information. So anybody who's written a biography, I'm sure, is listening to this going, oh, do I understand what she's talking about? I had thousands and thousands of pages of transcripts from these interviews, so I had to decide what would stay in, what would go away, how to organize it best into a narrative. Because that was the other challenge. My specialty is teaching narrative nonfiction, so I couldn't just put together some historical account. I had to weave this into a narrative, which was not easy considering all of the disparate interviews and the history and the issues. And so I'll let you decide if I did it or not.
Well, you definitely did. And the heroine of your story, Nafis Sadiq. Tell us a little about her.
Well, she's an incredible person, and she was born in 1929 in India and into a very prominent family there. Her father was one of the creators of the Pakistani government. So She could have never worked a day in her life, but she was an extraordinary person, and so as a teenager, she announced that she was going to become a doctor, and she tells her father this, that she's also going to change the world. How, she hasn't decided, but she's going to do that, and she actually did. And so this was a real kind of a blow on their family, because nobody else had ever worked. The women didn't work. And so her father, though, was a huge proponent of education for girls. And this actually became a theme in Nafisa's platform at the UN. And so he decided that he was going to permit this. And so she went to medical school. She became a doctor in 1954. And then she started one of the world's first family planning agencies in Pakistan, and was working on getting women around the country access to birth control. And she was approached by the United Nations Population Fund, which had just begun in 1969, and they asked her if she would be interested in coming to work for them, and she said no. And the head of the UNFPA was a man named Rafael Salas, and he was very clever, very savvy diplomat, and so he appealed to Nafisa's ego, and he said, well, you can do a much bigger job of changing the world at the UN than you can do in Pakistan. There you're working on at a national level. At the UN, you can work on a global level. And so they lured her away, and she became the first woman to ever be a director at the United Nations of an agency. And she put forth a really kind of groundbreaking paradigm where she convinced governments that the most important tool to control their population was not the kind of quotas that we're familiar with, things like China's one-child policy, but rather to educate girls and to give women and couples access to birth control. Because as she said in a quote to the New York Times, regardless of country or culture, no woman in the world wants to have a baby every year. And she felt by giving women access to their human rights and the control over their own fertility, the birth rate would automatically drop. Well, this was a huge shift in thinking and one that had not previously been tried. And so at the Cairo Conference on the International Conference on Population and Development in 1994, she put forth this paradigm and promoted it, and it was agreed to around the world by 183 different governments. And so now we kind of take this for granted. You know, everybody knows that education is one of the number one tools to limiting population, but this is where it all came from.
Well, in 1969, when she first got involved, well, I imagine that the opposition was really great. You know, I mean, in terms of the Catholic Church and all other entities that are opposed to that kind of thing.
Yeah, and P.S., that has not changed with the Catholic Church.
Right, yeah.
There were countries where you could literally not say, as a diplomat, you could not say the words family planning, or they would escort you to the airport and put you on a plane. In some countries in Africa, it was illegal. Some countries in Latin America, countries like Russia, wanted to grow their population. And so, no, this was not like a universally embraced concept. And if you think about it, when you get issues of power, politics, religion, and sex involved, it's not an easy situation to deal with.
Well, Kathleen Miller, in your book, Champion of Choice, you also talk about all of the other issues that are involved, and in not just birth control and abortion rights and so on, but domestic abuse, child marriage. What are some of those?
Well, these are all the issues that Nafees put forth as her agenda when she was at UNFPA, and a lot of these things were really controversial. People said, we don't really have any business be involved in these affairs, things like incest. She would meet with heads of state, and this is something I think people don't realize. The great asset of the UN is they are the only body that has access to all of the governments around the world. So this kind of political change at the upper echelons of government, they are the ones that have the ability to do it. And so she would meet with heads of state and, you know, like meeting with Daniel Ortega and saying, you have an enormous problem with teenage pregnancy in Nicaragua. You know, you need to have sex education. You need to have access to birth control for these girls. And, you know, these were things that nobody really wanted to talk about. In fact, she said she'd be in meetings and the country representatives would be kicking her under the table to shut up. And so, because she was the one who brought a lot of these issues to the table, I felt like I wanted to cover them, you know, to demonstrate the breadth of her career.
So when she became involved with the UN after, you know, 15 years as being a doctor in Pakistan, to what degree did she continue to stay involved in Pakistani issues?
She became just like an unofficial advisor to them, and the government of Pakistan, as you know, has been very volatile and for the most part became progressively more conservative. And so she has had a relationship with every president and prime minister in Pakistan since her father was part of the government. So they look at her as a great resource, but at the same time, you know, the record there, of course, for women is not the best.
So do they listen to her? Do they like her? Do they hate her? What?
They all respect her because she does not come to them with a political agenda. She comes to them with a lot of facts for how they can... I mean, Pakistan has one of the most rapidly growing populations in the world. And so she had a great relationship with Benazir Bhutto. And, you know, she tries to explain to, like, Pakistani leaders, among others, that one of the best things that you can do for quality of life in your country is to provide people with access to birth control. And so I think they listen to her, but on the issues of women's rights, there are a lot of other forces at work.
What about Nafees Sadiq's personal life? Did she marry? Did she have good relationships with men?
She did, and she had a wonderful marriage. She married in 1954, right after she got out of medical school. And her husband was a captain in the Pakistani army. He was an incredibly open-minded and liberal gentleman. I interviewed him at length, and he was a very sweet person. Unfortunately, we lost him a couple of years ago. So they had a marriage that lasted, I think it was 63 years. And so
wow.
He was very, very supportive of her work. And she said that's one of the reasons that she married him, because she talked to him at length that she intended to work, she intended to have a career, and he felt like her work was important. In fact, he even gave up his own career and moved to New York City so she could join the UN, which is pretty unusual for a man from their culture.
And did she have any children?
She has three children of her own, and she had adopted two girls from her husband's family that became orphans, and so she raised those two girls as well.
And what about her children? Are they involved in her work?
No, none of them, and they just have a normal family life, and, you know, they're very proud of their mother, but for whatever reason, nobody went on and continued in politics or advocacy.
Well, so now the book is here.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going around and talking about the book, and how are people reacting to it? What are you hearing from people?
Well, I really haven't heard anything negative except a couple of reviewers said that it was too long. But everybody has been really kind of blown away by learning about Nafis. And I had a couple of themes in mind when I wrote the book. Two of them, I just got back from Italy and I gave a couple of talks there. And so it was really well received. One was how women can make political change. And so this, I looked at weaving that theme into Champion of Choice. I wanted to look at Nafisa's life as kind of a blueprint for making that happen. And so I very much wove in all the how-to in case you also have an agenda of changing the world to show you how she did it. And the other theme, which has been very well received, I kind of half-jokingly called How to Raise Your Daughter to Be a World Leader, because I gave a talk on that actually in Rome at the American University. And I think that I was really astonished with studying her life and all the stories she told me about her family, and began to look at those as these are the tools that made her who she is. And so I wanted to weave these into the text also. But whenever I've given a talk, people are just really, really complimentary and very excited to learn about all that she's done.
And she set out to change the world, and you say that she has. Which issues that she set out to really make a difference in have changed or lessened or gone away?
Yeah, I think the big one, which affects everybody, no matter what your political persuasion, is that when she joined the UN Population Fund in 1971, the average global birth rate was 6 children per mother, and by the time she left 30 years later, that birth rate had been cut in half to 3 children per mother. So, you know, we now have a population of 7 billion people, and it would have been obviously much, much greater if she had not persevered for 30 years with this mission to get women around the world access to birth control.
And now what about you? What are you going to, is this it? You're done? You'll never write another book?
I'm retiring.
No, I don't believe you. What are you going to do next?
Well, last year I was in Brazil. I'm writing the life story of a woman from Brazil, and her name is Denilda dos Santos. She was a political dissident who escaped from the death squads. They had already killed her brother, and she has a very wild story. It's like an Indiana Jones sequel, except it happens to be true. So I went down there and I followed her around all these scenes of her life in the favelas of Rio, up in the mountains of Minas Gerais. Went down the Amazon River with her, and then we came to Italy, and I followed her around Italy to see all of these scenes, because that's where she went as a political refugee and created this whole life for herself. So that's what I'm working on now.
Sounds great. Well, I hope you'll come and talk to us about that one. This book is called Champion of Choice, and Kathleen Miller, the author, will be at the Capitola Book Cafe Monday. I believe it is Monday, August 12th at 7:30. And congratulations on Champion of Choice, Kathleen Miller. Thanks for coming over and talking to us on From the Bookshelf.
Oh, it's been a great pleasure.
Well, that closes the book on this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you had a good time, and you'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, you can check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. I want to thank my guest, Kathleen Miller. Her book, Champion of Choice, The Life and Legacy of Women's Advocate Nafis Sadiq. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. Thanks, Francis. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.